The Everglades, from The Highways and Byways of Florida. There is a compelling charm about the unknown, and in the Everglades that charm is still potent. They have always been a region of mystery. Stories are told of pirate ships laden with booty being chased to the Florida coast, where they evaded their pursuers by taking refuge within the fastnesses of the glades. The winding streams of the southern part of the peninsula are reputed to flow over treasures in scuttled boats, and their banks to be the hiding place of hoards of buried wealth left by old sea rovers. Much money has been spent in attempts to discover the treasures. Although the mild winter of Florida draws constantly increasing numbers thither, the tip of the peninsula is the last portion of America to be intimately explored. Our own surveys of some of the more intricate parts of its coast have not been dependable until recently. The first organized expedition crossed the Everglades in 1883, and maps made not long ago portrayed good-sized rivers 50 miles long traversing the region where, in reality, the vague waterways are scarcely worthy to be called streams. The Everglades occupy a shallow basin 130 miles north and south, and 70 east and west, which makes a total area much the same as that of the state of Connecticut. Yet this vast expanse, bordered as it is by lines of commerce and fashionable travel, is even now almost unplotted and unvisited. Its only human dwellers are a few hundred Indians who thread its lonely water paths in primitive dugout canoes. It is not exactly land, and not exactly water. There is too much water to travel by land, and too much rank saw-edge grass to journey freely by water. The only relief to its level, prairie-like monotony, it's a dotting of islets heavy with tropical growths and usually plumed with one or two palmettos. Florida is a broad limestone mountaintop, much of which is covered by a mantle of sand. It has remarkably copious springs, and these springs are the source of the water of the Everglades. The water forms a veritable lake that nowhere is stagnant or wholly at rest. Rains furnish only a small percentage of the clear, limpid, and palatable water, and the springs account for the rest. No stream of any kind runs into the basin, yet numerous creeks and rivers lead out of it. The rim of the basin has an altitude of about 12 feet above low tide. On the east, it is within 3 to 12 miles off the coast, but on the west side recedes much farther, and here lie the dark, watery woodlands known as the Big Cypress, a trackless labyrinth of swamps, lagoons, creeks, and low, fertile islands, all deep buried in the shadows of a mighty cypress forest. The rock floor of the Everglades Basin is usually found at a depth not exceeding 6 feet, but in places is twice that far down. Wherever it is struck with a pole or an oar, it gives out a somewhat hollow metallic sound. Almost the entire floor is covered with a layer of muck, which varies in thickness from a few inches to several feet. In this muck grows the sawgrass, sometimes attaining a height of 10 feet. Its vigor never varies, for neither heat nor cold ever weakens its vicious energy. The grass hides the water, save in the numerous little channels, which wind aimlessly about, sometimes coming to a blank end, sometimes broadening into a clear space abloom with pond lilies. These leads, or openings, are full of promise to the explorer, but are usually only a snare. Along the eastern and western edges of the lake are uncounted islands, some of them alluvial, but most outcrops of the rock of the basin covered with a rich mold. The former are wet, the latter are habitable, and occasionally one will have a dry, cultivable area hundreds of acres in extent that responds generously to the rather fitful labor of the Seminoles. The forests that cover the islands are very luxuriant. Vines abound and attain great size. Wherever the ground is dry enough, the Florida arrowroot flourishes. This is the mainstay of the Seminoles and supplies delicate and digestible flour and starch. Wild flowers are remarkably profuse, including rare and lovely orchids. On many of the islands grow giant ferns, the fronds of which attain a length of 10 feet. Animal life is fairly abundant in the islanded parts. Here, deer are found, and now and then a bear or panther. Otters are plentiful, and these and alligators are hunted by the Seminoles for their skins. There are numerous snakes, including the poisonous rattlesnake and moccasins, but they do not hang from the trees in the fine festoons that used to be pictured. One wonders that the Seminoles should go habitually bare-limbed from knee down in this snake-infested wilderness. There is such a dearth of stagnant water that few breeding places are furnished for insects. Even mosquitoes are lacking except along the borders, but the thick, abundant foliage encourages the gnats and small flies and fleas are plentiful in the Indian camps. In climate, the Everglades know neither sudden change nor extremes of heat and cold. Winter chill is softened and summer heat made genial. The rainy season includes all the summer months and the early fall. The rest of the year is fairly dry, though showers are not entirely lacking. Such are the difficulties of penetrating the Everglades that what we have learned of them during the past 3 centuries has been learned in fragments, and with pain and peril. The first white man to enter their confines was a Spaniard who was shipwrecked in the Strait of Florida and became the captive and slave of a callous chief who was known as the Lord of the Everglades. The tribe called the whole region Miami, a name which still persists in that of Miami, and they called the Everglades the Lake of the Sweet Water. The Spanish captive's name for them was the Lake of the Holy Spirit. He was among the Indians for 17 years, during which time he was concerned chiefly in a search for gold and for the spring of fadeless youth. He found no gold, and though he affirmed that he bathed in every pool and spring, his youth departed and he died. The Kalos tribe presently disappeared from the region, and at length a remnant of the Seminoles settled in the Everglades, which they called the Grassy Water. The 7 Years' War with the whites had not ended, and later fresh difficulties arose with the result that military detachments made various incursions into the glades from 1841 to 1856. One of these, which is fairly typical, occurred in June 1855. 63 men with an Indian guide set out from the eastern edge in canoes. When water leads failed them, the boats were forced through the sawgrass, partly by poling, partly by wading and shoving. Often the grass had to be cut away in front, and the men suffered greatly from wounds made by its sharp-toothed edges. At night, they had to sleep camped in the canoes. Finally, the grass barrier became so dense they were obliged to turn back after having gone a winding way of 120 miles, or, in a direct line, 53 miles. The expedition of 1883, which has been referred to, was undertaken by 4 white men and 6 Negro oarsmen. They had 2 large canoes and several smaller ones and carried provisions for 60 days. The start was made October 21st from Punta Raza at the mouth of the Caloosahatchee, and on the first day of November the party reached Lake Okeechobee. Beyond that, they encountered a dense tangle of grass, scrub willow, and custard apple, through which they were only able to advance a few hundred yards a day. Presently, this was succeeded by watery prairies of sawgrass to which they set fire, but as the water here was only 4 feet deep, progress continued to be slow and laborious. Not until late in the month did they find deeper water. Then they got along faster, and at last descended the Shark River to Whitewater Bay at the tip of the peninsula. A more ambitious expedition was undertaken in the early spring of 1892. 21 men with 2 cypress skiffs and 2 canvas boats entered the glades from Fort Shackelford in the middle of the peninsula, about 40 miles south of Lake Okeechobee. They expected to travel 5 miles a day, but even this slow rate could not be maintained. 4 days after starting, it became necessary to leave behind one of the skiffs and some of the baggage. Leaders and laborers worked alike, often standing waist-deep in water and muck, cutting away the sawgrass to make an opening for the boats, which they then shoved ahead by main strength. At times, portages were unavoidable, and the men had to carry the boats' cargoes on their backs. A burden-bearer would frequently get into a mud hole up to his waist and was only able to extricate himself by laying hold of a boat. The party camped at night on small islands when they could, but if none was available, some slept in the boats, and others cut sawgrass, piled it on that which was growing, and spread over the pile heavy rubber blankets, thus contriving a rude swaying bed. Several of the men gave out from incessant and arduous labor, and provisions ran short, so that only half rations were served, eked out by terrapin and a few fish and birds procured along the way. Their baggage was abandoned. Distant Indian fires had been seen from time to time, and on April 4th, the men saw and hailed an old Seminole whom they persuaded to guide them to Miami. There they arrived haggard and exhausted 3 days later. The easiest natural approaches to the glades are by the way of the New River and the Miami on the east coast. The other outlets afford only difficult pathways at best. The New River flows forth in a somewhat sweeping but gentle stream. The Miami has worn for itself a way through the rocky rim of the Great Basin and comes tumbling in a noisy flood down a 10-foot fall in 300 yards. There is undoubtedly agricultural value in the rich deposit of mud at the bottom of the great inland lagoon, and if water could be withdrawn, the region would attract population and be marvelously productive. The reclamation of the Everglades has been a subject of public discussion from almost the time of Florida's acquisition by the United States. The first contract for draining the region was made in 1881, and work continued for several years, but without very important results. In 1906, the task was resumed, and considerable progress has been made in opening canals to the coast. It is estimated that the work now underway will make available 1 million acres of land, particularly adapted to raising sugarcane, oranges, and garden truck. The drainage channels that have been opened make crossing the Everglades a favorite trip for Florida tourists. There is considerable advantage for sightseers in having a short route across the lower part of the state, but the novelty of it is the chief attraction. The usual course between Fort Myers and West Palm Beach. You leave Fort Myers in a little launch which goes up the Caloosahatchee. The river is broad at first, but after a while becomes narrow and tortuous. You stop for the night at the village of La Belle on the borders of the Everglades. The next morning you go on up the river and through a canal to Lake Okeechobee. The canals have lowered the water of the lake so that it is very shallow and has a broad border of exposed bottom. Several little lighthouses have been erected to guide the boats across it. Late in the day, you arrive at West Palm Beach. Some authorities consider the Seminole dwellers of the Everglades the most picturesque Indians in the United States. Their strange environment, their habits of living, and their dress are all romantically interesting. For more than a decade after the Seven Years' War ended in 1842, they continued in their wilderness retreat unmolested. Then, some engineers engaged in a government survey of Florida camped not far from the home of old Billy Bowlegs, the leading chief of his tribe. One day, old Billy was dismayed to find that marauders had been in his garden and deliberately cut and torn to pieces some banana plants, which were the pride of his heart. When he went to the engineers' camp to complain, the men admitted that the deed was theirs, but insolently refused to make amends. As a result, the Indians went on the warpath, and the cost to the government was a number of lives and thousands of dollars. At the end of 3 years, old Billy Bowlegs and a band of 150 men, women, and children were induced to emigrate. The Seminoles at present in the Everglades probably do not number over 300. They do not make much of a showing in the vast expanse of the Everglades that they inhabit. If you journeyed into that watery wilderness, you might travel scores of miles and not see an Indian. They live in small, widely separated colonies that usually consist of 5 or 6 families. A typical camp covers about an acre of dry land. The ordinary dwelling consists of 6 upright poles, 3 on a side, and a gable roof of palmetto thatch. It has an earthen floor, and the main articles of furniture are large tables which nearly fill the interior and on which the Indians eat and sleep. There are chests of old clothes and tools and guns, barrels and boxes for provisions, and a sewing machine. An old sheet or blanket generally hangs down on the northerly side in winter to keep out the winds and rain. In the center of the camp is a circular shed used for cooking. Under this is a fire, from which logs radiate like spokes from the hub of a wheel. As the ends burn away, the logs are pushed toward the center. Anyone is welcome to share the Indians' food with them at mealtime. The standard dish is a stew made by cooking meat in a large kettle and thickening it with vegetables and meal. A spoon is placed in the kettle, and each person takes a single mouthful in turn, or you can reach in with your fingers and help yourself. When food is plentiful, the stew kettle is seldom empty. The squaws wear long calico dresses of blue or brown that have bright bands of red or yellow. Their most cherished ornaments are strings of colored beads. The beads are about the size of a small pea, and the preferred colors are turquoise blue and a light red. A string of beads is given to the girl baby by the time she is a year old, and each notable event in her life is made an occasion for giving her more beads. But in advanced age, some are taken away. There are women who carry as much as 25 pounds of these beads around their necks. They always go without head covering and barefooted. Silver coins are frequently beaten into various designs and fashioned into jewelry for personal adornment. The men acquire store clothes such as the whites wear, but have an antipathy for trousers. Their habits are so amphibious that they prefer bare legs. Some still dress in the old Seminole manner and have a tunic tied on with a bright sash and a red turban made of a shawl or many handkerchiefs. An Indian will frequently wear half a dozen shirts at the same time. Silver earrings are worn very generally by men, women, and children. In the vicinity of the habitations is a little clearing where are raised scanty crops of corn, squashes, sweet potatoes, and sugarcane. Chickens and razorback hogs run about wild. The old cane mill is used to extract the juice of the sugarcane, and this juice is transported into whiskey by means of a still, crudely constructed from an iron pot with a wooden cover, a length of iron pipe, and a box of water. When under the influence of liquor, the Seminole is quarrelsome, bites like a dog, fights with his companions and all the members of his family, but seldom with white men whom he fears even when drunk. On occasions of carousal, one of the Indians always keeps sober to look after the others. After a spree in a town of the whites, as soon as the drinkers recover their usual gravity and gentleness, they disappear into the Everglades fastnesses as silently as they came. The Indian has a mysterious ability to cross the Everglades at will. When the water is high, he can pole his dugout the entire width of the sawgrass waste in 4 days, but he is not a satisfactory guide, for he is easily discouraged and lacks resourcefulness. If the route through the Everglades is made difficult by low water and canoes have to be hauled through mud and sawgrass, the Indian is apt to conclude that he is sick and needs whiskey. If the liquor is not forthcoming, he at once gives up his job, quite regardless of all contracts. Some of the men occasionally work for truck farmers, but most of the tribe regard such employment with haughty disdain. Nor are the willing ones dependable as laborers. An Indian who refused to do some light field work at $1 a day readily accepted an offer of a moderate sum for capturing a live otter wanted by a zoo, without traps, marks, or other injury. He spent several weeks in securing the creature, and it bit his thumb half off, yet he seemed satisfied with the compensation that was far less than he could have earned hoeing tomatoes. One of the Indians told a white man that he would like to go to school and that he wanted to attend for 2 weeks. 2 weeks are not enough, the white man commented. You must go a long time to learn. No, the Indian responded, me smart learn plenty in 2 weeks. A Seminole who was asked if he ever prayed replied, me hunt 2-3 days, get no deer, have big talk to great spirit, get deer. Me want go in canoe, no water, me talk to great spirit, water come plenty. Indian, he buy iron pot and pipe and sugarcane water make much whiskey. Me tell him stop, he no stop, drink, 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 all the same like white man. Me bury him, then say lily bit prayer. The Everglades Indians show little inclination to adopt the religion of the white race. Missionaries rarely allow a savage to escape them, but they find the Seminoles peculiarly elusive. Not many years ago, a missionary settled near an Indian encampment, whereupon the natives moved to the recesses of the Big Cypress Swamp and declared they would go still farther if the missionary followed. The Seminoles have an annual corn dance that begins with the new moon in June and lasts from 10 to 20 days. On the night of the full moon, they dance around the festal pole from sunset until sunrise. The dancing is not as whole, very spirited. Those who take part walk around in a circle about 30 yards in diameter and talk until, at the signal of a scream, they jump up and down. Sometimes the younger girls vary the performance by a rough-and-tumble wrestling match. Casualties are not uncommon during these festivities. On one occasion, Jimmy Jumper ran amok and killed 5 Indians before he himself was shot down. Marriage ties are lightly regarded. One squaw got drunk and pounded her husband. He did not strike back, but left her and the camp, and married a widow who was a score of years his senior and had 6 children. The tribe inflicted no additional punishment. Implicit obedience to their leaders is one of the Indian traits. If a man sentenced to death is granted permission to go to town for a few days, he is sure to return at a time appointed for him to be the chief figure in an execution. A Seminole often takes the medicine of the white man for slight attacks of illness, but in serious cases he calls in the medicine man of his own people. One of the worst foes of the tribe is measles, which easily becomes epidemic. If the disease itself does not terminate the life of the sufferers, the medicine man puts in the finishing strokes with his mummery. By means of bleedings, poultices, and closings, he disposes of the disease and patient, both. The dead are left on top of the ground, wrapped in blankets, and further protected by a pen built over the body. When a man's squaw dies, he wears his shirt till it rots off. When a squaw loses her husband, she refrains from combing her hair for 3 months. Aside from these formalities, little reverence is shown for the dead, and when Tom Tigger's grave was robbed and his bones taken for exhibition, the Indians were indifferent. Surveyors are beginning to invade the Seminole country. Lumber, bark, and fruit-growing companies are gaining a foothold. Hunters roam over the preserves in increasing numbers, and the state is going ahead energetically with drainage projects. The Indians have become anxious over their future as they see the water in the Everglades receding, game becoming scarcer, and the white men locating on more and more of what was formerly an almost inaccessible wilderness to civilized humanity. Some adjustments must be made for them, but negotiation with them is not easy, for their general opinion of the whites is that they are no good and lie too much. The End, read by Leonidas for Lit2Go on the web at fcit.usf.edu.